Academy course on bubbles, blooms, and busts. It's been a pleasure so far here, and we're working on lecture three tonight. One of the things that you have to understand in terms of predicting bubbles and busts and determining where you are in something, it's part theory, the Austrian theory of the business cycle, but it's part of an art too, to notice anomalies in the economy. I just noticed, for example, that the VIX, which measures volatility in the stock market, I don't know if you're going to be able to see this, but and this is a product you can actually buy to sort of short the market. VXX is double the movement of the VIX, or the volatility index in stock market. And I just pulled up this two-year chart, and the chart begins at a high of 227, and it's down now at 14, which indicates that the stock market is not very volatile, but it also indicates to me that there's a very, you know, the notion that there could be a return to volatility. I don't know if you can see this, but that's a strong downward movement in a particular security. Tonight, we're going to be looking at Austrians in the mainstream in terms of how well they've been able to understand and predict economic crises. And so just to reiterate what we've covered so far is that with mainstream economists, and this includes, you know, everything from Chicago to Keynesian economists, that for them, prediction is key. They want to build models that are accurate and are able to predict the future. Second, their analysis is at the aggregate level. And so that they tend to focus things on, like on the total money supply, on GDP, things of that nature. So it's a very, it's an analysis based at a highly aggregate level. In terms of monetary policy, the mainstream believes in following rules or following the discretion of policymakers. Monetary rules are things like the Taylor rule, monetary growth targets, inflation targeting, things of that nature that are based on the work of Irving Fisher, Milton Friedman, John Taylor, etc. For the mainstream, money is neutral in the economy. And that means that when the central bank adds to the monetary base, it doesn't disrupt relative prices. And so this is one of those things that you will recall that, you know, mainstream economists are willing to put up with abstractions or unrealistic assumptions about the economy, and the idea that money is neutral is one of those assumptions. They'll often admit that money can have effects, but they usually will just dismiss those notions as very short-term or very small effects on the economy, things that they can't measure, they can't see, and therefore don't really exist. For a large part, mainstream believes in animal spirits or the psychology of the market, that things go wrong in the economy because of psychological conditions. And so they believe that that government policy should be aimed at disrupting these animal spirits and keeping everybody happy and fully invested in the economy. And while this is certainly true of Keynesian economists, it also washes over into other schools of economic thought because their policy is also aimed at maintaining psychological stability in the economy. And they often, they might not admit it, but they've certainly said it a number of times in the past, that they're all about making a new era in the economy, that they believe that they can fine-tune and supercharge the economy by by applying the proper monetary and the proper fiscal policy, the proper regulatory policy, managing markets, including securities and derivatives and so on and so forth. So they think that economists, a small group of economists, with the assistance of Congress and the President, of course, can actually make new eras permanent prosperity. They also, and this is, dates back for hundreds of years, believe that the problem of the recession or the depression or the crisis is a lack of consumption. And you'll very often hear this in the news. They'll talk about, what happened to consumption in the previous month or the previous quarter, because you'll often hear this phrase, consumption is two-thirds of the economy, and that if you can juice up consumption somehow, for example, by the Fed believes that if they can raise the stock market, that will make people feel wealthier, and that will make them consume more. They'll consume more in the present and return the economy to trend growth. And, of course, in addition, they also believe in stimulating the economy through a variety of means, things like lower interest rates, things like quantitative easing, tax cuts, deficit spending, public works projects, and so forth. So that's what the mainstream is all about. And Austrians are pretty much the exact opposite. First of all, we don't believe that predicting is a science. You can make certain qualified predictions, but they're not quantitative, they're not related to specific time estimates and things of that nature, and that prediction in human action is simply not scientific. We believe that aggregate analysis is going to be fundamentally flawed and leave you open to making a lot of mistakes, and that you have to look at individual markets, individual prices, to see what's really going on in the economy. And with respect to monetary policy, of course, Austrians believe that things like money and the interest rate should be determined by the market, not by government, and that monetary system based on markets, particularly gold and silver, are a much more fundamentally sound approach to monetary policy. You could say we have no policy, just let the market do it. And with respect to interest rates, the same thing. You shouldn't have a central bank managing the price of global funds any more than you should have the government determining the price of shoes or bananas or concrete or anything else. Even mainstream economists realize that government determination of prices in product markets and labor markets causes distortions. But for some reason, they set all that aside when it comes to the interest rate. With respect to money and injections in the economy, as we said in the last class, the mainstream views money as neutral, where Austrians are very concerned about Cantillon effects from monetary injections that cause male investments, which ultimately undermine economic growth. One of the things about the Austrian theory of the business cycle that's very important is the cluster of errors that happened over the boom-bust cycle. The cluster of errors, however, for the Austrians, are the boom times, when people are making bad investments that ultimately will be revealed to be entrepreneurial errors. And so the Austrian theory predicts that when you have a boom, when you have easy monetary policy, that ultimately that's going to be revealed as a cluster of errors in the bust. Okay, instead of under consumption, that seems like an odd notion in economics that people would systematically underconsume. As far as I know, most people that I know, all my experience tells me that people love to consume, and that the more money they have, the more they'll consume, and that the real problem of the boom-bust cycle is a matter of misallocation of resources, sending signals that cause people to make bad investments and also to consume too much and to save too little. And so our answer to the boom-bust system, of course, is to have market-determined money and interest rates, to keep the government out of the economy as much as possible, and simply to allow markets to clear. One of the biggest problems in the current crisis, there are many, but one of the biggest and most fundamental issues is that the government never allowed the housing market to fully clear. They stepped in and prevented the clearing of markets, and we'll be talking about that much more in the remainder of the course, of course. Now, we're going to begin tonight's class, by looking at America's Great Depression, which was, in effect, a worldwide Great Depression, and look at how the mainstream saw events as they were occurring in the 1920s and early 30s, and Austrians, and how they viewed things during that same time period. So basically what we're going to try to do here tonight is to show and to demonstrate that Austrians have had a far superior insight into the major economic crises for the last 100 years and how the mainstream has basically completely blown it and why they blew it. Now, at the time, Irving Fisher was really the most prominent economist in America. He had received his PhD in Germany in 1896, and he taught at Yale University, and he was a big wig in the profession, and he continues to be a big wig in the profession. If you look at citations in the modern economic journals, what you'll find is that all the founding fathers of the American Economic Association, all the important economists from the progressive era, have basically dropped out of the discussion. Their names are basically lost in modern economic discourse. The one exception to that is Irving Fisher, and he's considered the founder of modern mainstream macroeconomics and monetary policy. And he was a big deal. Bob Formani, who's an Austrian economist who worked at the Dallas Federal Reserve, wrote about Fisher, and he concluded, quote, "Modern economics was going through tremendous changes during Fisher's college years, and he helped lead it in the direction that produced its current reliance on mathematics, general equilibrium analysis, and aggregate data sets for the calculation of various price indexes. In this transformative undertaking, he would be ranked along with Leon Varrow, Stanley Jevons, and Francis Edgeworth. His theoretical work touches on almost every major macroeconomic issue and is still regularly consulted and cited, not only by historians of economic thought, but also by practicing economists. That in itself sets him apart from most of his contemporaries. And I found a similar story when I looked in the economic journals for citations, and Irving Fisher was basically the only one who came up to any great extent. And I cover this whole discussion at greater length in my article from the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, 2008. Okay, so for Fisher, it was the first economics dissertation at Yale University. It was actually, his committee was made up of, I think, one economist and two members the mathematics faculty, because prior to this time, economics had very little math in it. And so the economists, even at Yale University, and even today, Yale is on the forefront of mathematical economics. They didn't have anybody who could really confirm what Fisher was doing. In 1892, his dissertation was published, Mathematical Investigation in Theory of Value and Prices. In 1913, he published The Purchasing Power of Money, which in conjunction with his 1925 book, The Dollar Problem, Not Business Cycle. And then in 1927, he published The Making of Index Numbers. And in fact, it was revealed in 1976 that he had written a paper where he, in effect, discovered the Phillips curve, the relationship between unemployment rate and the inflation rate. And the Phillips curve suggests that there's a trade-off between inflation and unemployment, that if you have higher inflation, you'll have less unemployment. And vice versa, if you have lower inflation, you'll have more unemployment, which of course creates the impression that inflation is a good thing, at least to the extent that it can create unemployment. Now, this is something that's been debated empirically in the profession. There's hundreds of articles on the Phillips curve, and basically it's sort of an inconclusive doctrine, but it's fundamentally flawed, the idea that inflation can cause jobs on a sustainable basis is nonsense, because we've obviously experienced periods with high inflation and high unemployment, and we've also experienced periods of low inflation and low unemployment. So there's no empirical consistency. Even if there was a short-term Phillips curve, in the long run, the Phillips curve is dead. So Fisher was famous for making predictions. He was quoted in the newspaper all the time, basically. One of his predictions with respect to the stock market occurred just 2 days after stock prices peaked in 1929, in the fall of 1929. Fisher said, quote, "There may be a recession in stock prices, but not anything in the nature of a crash. Dividend return on stocks are moving higher. This is not due to receding prices for stocks and will not be hastened by any anticipated crash, the possibility of which I fail to see." So there you are, right on the cliff there, Irving, and you make a prediction that stock prices are going to be stable. And he kept on making predictions. On October 15th, he made his famous statement defending the stock market, and that the economy and the stock market in the U.S. were going to be at a permanently high plateau, except in this case, it wasn't really a plateau. Fisher was suggesting that stock prices were permanently high and going to head higher. Well, stock prices continued to go lower. And as a matter of fact, there was a mini crash there between the 15th and the 22nd of October, and Fisher dismissed that as an irrational short-term turn in the stock market, and he said that stock prices were now down to hard rock. In other words, there was a layer there where it was easy for stocks to fall, but they had already fallen to the level where they could not fall any further. Unfortunately, stock prices continued to fall at a rapid rate. Now, on October 24th, he said that, quote, "the value of stock prices are too low," implying that stocks had fallen through this hard rock of income potential from corporations who sold stock on the stock market, and that implying that this was a good buying opportunity for stocks, even much lower than on the 22nd. However, unfortunately for Fisher, the next day, the New York Times reported that the market had experienced that day the worst stock crash in its history. And over the next few days after that crash, stocks would lose another 25% of their value. By November 3rd, Fisher believed that stocks were absurdly low, but unfortunately for investors that had been listening to Fisher, they had much further to go. And in sum total, after the stock market had completely crashed out, this overall stock market lost 90% of its value, and stock trusts, which were an early form of something like a mutual fund where a company or bank would buy, purchase a portfolio of stocks, and individuals could then invest in this portfolio. And Fisher actually thought that because of these stock trusts and because individuals could invest in a multitude of stocks with a small amount of money, he thought that was a great thing and that would prevent the market from going much lower. But unfortunately, the stock trust actually ended up losing more money in the overall stock market. So just about everything Fisher said about the stock market and the stock market crash of 1929 into 1930 was completely wrong. Well, of course, Fisher had to explain himself. And what he said was that he found most explanations of the crash that were lacking or were insufficient or really didn't explain the stock market crash. Eventually, he would admit that there were theoretical imperfections in price indexes. And so let's stop and step back and look exactly at what Fisher was up to. He proposed that it wasn't a stock market problem. It was a dollar problem. And that if we could stabilize the value of the dollar, that all the other macroeconomic problems in the economy would go away. So he thought that stabilization was the key. And he actually recommended that if people wanted to come in to the Treasury and turn in their notes, their dollars, for gold, that if the price of gold had risen, that that the size of the coin that would be issued would become smaller. And if the price of gold had fallen, the size of the coin would have to be made larger. Now, of course, that seems absurd, but what the Fed did to try to imitate Fisher's plan was to target the price index, to target the producer price index, which Fisher himself created and started issuing reports in the 1920s. Where he took a basket of commodities that were produced in the economy and measured their weekly prices and created a price index out of those individual prices so you get some idea if prices were rising or if prices were falling. And Fisher's suggestion to the Fed or to the central bank was that you want to look at that producer price index, and if prices are rising, you want to reduce the money supply. If prices are falling, you want to increase the money supply. And that would create a stable dollar. It would be a more practical means than Fisher's own suggestion, and that policymakers could manage that type of policy. And Fisher saw that, indeed, the Fed had kept the value of the dollar stable by increasing the supply of money to offset the natural deflation that would have been taking place. And after the stock market crash, he realized that there were theoretical imperfections in the price index approach. He said, quote, during and after the World War, and that's World War I, of course, the wholesale commodity price level, responded very exactly to both inflation and deflation. If it did not do so during the inflationary period from 1923 to 1929, This was partly because trade had grown with the inflation and partly because technological improvements had reduced the cost so that many producers were able to get higher profits without charging higher prices. Now, there's a lot to that statement, and let's break it down a little bit here. So he's saying that, you know, for the early period before the Fed started this policy of stable dollar, that the price index responded well to inflation and deflation. And Fisher is talking about monetary inflation and monetary deflation, unlike modern mainstream economists who refer to inflation and price and deflation relative to prices rather than money. The next thing to take note is that Fisher says the inflationary period from 1923 to 1929. And this is very interesting because the Austrians argue that it was a problem of inflation that caused the boom in the economy and the bubble in the stock market. And Murray Rothbard, in his book America's Great Depression, basically demonstrates that the Fed was inflating the money supply. And he's been criticized for this by the Chicago School and others, that the period wasn't really a period of monetary inflation. But even Irving Fisher, the godfather of modern mainstream macroeconomics, and Milton Friedman looked up to him as the most important American economist in history, even Fisher says that it was an inflationary period. And finally, note the idea that technological improvements had reduced cost so that producers were able to get higher profits without charging higher prices. And the higher profits were, of course, stimulating the stock market. So there's a lot to that. Now, on the other hand, we have Ludwig von Mises and the Austrians. And von Mises had many of his most important contributions actually occur before the Great Depression, the onset of the Great Depression. And as a matter of fact, some would argue the majority of his important contributions occur during this time. In 1912, he published The Theory of Money and Credit. Tremendous contribution to the Austrian school, where he basically links up microeconomics and macroeconomics. Austrians don't like to view the two as separate entities. We like to view them as that the economy, you need to be able to understand all elements of the economy from a theoretical perspective simultaneously. And through the regression theorem, Mises was able to link money with the microeconomic economy, building upon Carl Menger's work on the origin of money. He shows basically how money is valued in the economy. And more importantly, he introduces the early notion of the Austrian theory of the business cycle and how an expansion of credit can cause a boom in the economy, which ultimately is revealed as male investments in the bust. 1919, he publishes Nation, State, and Economy. In 1922, he publishes Socialism, an Economic and Sociological Analysis. This is important in many respects. It builds on his earlier essay on socialism, where he demonstrates that pure socialism is economically irrational and pure socialism is impossible, simply can't work. And, so this builds on that initial essay. And importantly, the whole idea of economic calculation, where economic calculation, how it takes place in an economy, and you know that analysis is exactly the type of analysis that Austrians are talking about when we look at, you know, you have to understand how the economy works before you can understand its problems. So So the theory of money and credit and socialism and economic and sociological analysis are incredibly important for understanding how the economy works. They're not easy reads by any means, but they're, if you really want to understand how an economy works, those are two books that you're going to have to try to master over time. In 1923, he publishes Stabilization of the Monetary Unit, where he starts his investigation of Keynes and Irving Fisher and their plans to stabilize the dollar or the monetary unit economy. And he starts to lay out his critique of why that approach is wrongheaded, because basically it's stabilization of the monetary unit through a central bank. And Mises shows that that approach is wrongheaded. In 1928, he publishes Monetary Stabilization and Cyclical Policy. And here's where he directly confronts Irving Fisher's notion of a stable dollar. And then along the way, he publishes Liberalism in 1927 and Epistemological Problems in 1933. So, not surprisingly, Mises' view of the situation is much different from Irving Fisher. Fisher thinks that everything's great, and Mises is very concerned about the spread of central banking throughout the world. You know, we get the Fed and Federal Reserve Act passed in 1913, and during World War I, everybody goes off the gold standard, and there's all sorts of monetary problems in Europe as a result of all that. And central banks are trying to manage the whole process. In 1924, Mises predicted that credit en stalt would eventually crash. And credit en stalt was a large bank and credit operation in his native land of Austria that ultimately would crash and be the final sort of weight that brought down the world economy. In 1928, he said, in published work, he said, because of the imperfections of the index number, these calculations would necessarily lead in time to errors of very considerable proportions. So those exact theoretical imperfections of the price index approach that Fisher admitted to in 1932, Mises was already on it. He already explained why price indexes are not a truly scientific approach to measuring prices. Mises didn't think that the idea of measuring prices in aggregates was either valuable or possible. In the same publication, he said, quote, it is clear that the crisis must come sooner or later. It is also clear that the crisis must always be caused, primarily and directly, by the change in the conduct of the banks. If we speak of error on the part of the banks, however, we must point to the wrong they do in encouraging the upswing. The fault lies not with the policy of raising the interest rate, but only with the fact that it was raised too late. And so, you know, he's on to Fisher's approach is wrongheaded. He's clearly stating that Fisher's approach is actually causing an economic crisis to take place, and that the epicenter of this cause is the banking system, which was, of course, managed by the central bank, and also that a lot of people had the wrong-headed idea that economic crises are brought about when central banks raise interest rates in the economy. And, of course, it's really the fact that they lower interest rates in the economy and only later responded to rising price inflation pressures to raise the interest rate in the macro economy. Okay, in terms of prevention and cure. 1928, again, same publication, Misa says, the only way to do away with or even to alleviate the periodic return of the trade cycle or business cycle with its denouement, the crisis, is to reject the fallacy that prosperity can be produced by using banking procedures to make credit cheap. In other words, you can't create prosperity by printing up money. And of course, this basic lesson is true today as it ever was, and suggests severe problems in current monetary policy. Okay, so along with Mises, who obviously recognized the crisis, obviously recognized its cause and the economic fallacies that it was based on, along with him, F.A. Hayek is said to have written about the oncoming crisis, but I've never been able to track down exactly where he said that. So if anybody out there reads German, you might want to do some research on that. It might make a nice Mises Daily article, if not something bigger. A fellow student in Austria of Mises, Felix Sommeré, noted and discussed the economic crisis. And in the United States, Benjamin Anderson, who is a kind of an Austrian economist, and E.C. Harwood also made accurate and timely predictions of a looming economic crisis. So there weren't many Austrians around in those days. The basic idea about Mises' business cycle had just gotten some attention because it was rejected in the German-speaking world, and it's really only when F.A. Hayek, who was the director of the Austrian Business Cycle Institute under Mises, when he went to the London School of Economics in 1931, he was working on business cycle theory, capital theory, and the like, and he began to spread the ideas of the Austrian economists to the English-speaking world. Benjamin Anderson was also doing the same thing in the United States. And there was a fellow in Britain who also was busy translating Austrian works. But F.A. Hayek spread the Austrian business cycle at the London School. He influenced Lionel Robbins, who wrote a great book on the Great Depression. It's something that is worth reading and having in your library. At the time, Robbins was fully under the influence of the Austrian school, and he was also a very good writer. And so that's something worth keeping your eye out for. But I want to point out that not only was had Fisher taken the wrong approach, but he had been heavily rewarded and had risen to a tremendous degree of prominence in American academia. He was a president 1 year of the American Economic Association, and he was also made president of the American Statistical Association. He was a full professor at Yale University. He was a multimillionaire. He was an inventor. He invented the Rolodex, the folding chair, and some other things. So those things give you some idea that he had this engineering mentality that you see in his inventions, but you also see it in his economics. It's not really appropriate. He was a multimillionaire. As a result of all these things, and of course, lost almost all of his money in the Great Depression. I think he lost his own fortune. I think he lost most of his wife's family fortune, and he lost a good part of the endowment of his university. But he struck out against the Austrians. He denounced the Austrian a priori method and all those who maintain that economics is not, never can be, a true science based on their contention on the fact that social phenomena are not constant. And so you can see this is deeply ingrained in Fisher's thinking, that you can model human behavior along the lines of the physical sciences, physics, and so forth, and that social phenomena, in some sense, can be constant. So he was a great believer in manipulating human behavior. He was a proponent of eugenics, whereby the human race can be genetically modified and perfected. We make it impossible for certain races and certain types of people to be able to reproduce. And you match up the genetically superior men and women in society so that they produce a genetically superior offspring. And this is true for all the progressive economists. They believed in manipulating society, of getting children out of the workforce, forcing them into public schools, getting women out of the workforce, forcing them to stay at home. And so they were manipulators, basically, in every sense of the word. And I found this quote from Fisher early on, which sort of gives you some insight into his overall socialist mentality and ideology. 1907, he wrote, "The world consists of two classes, the educated and the ignorant, and it is essential for progress that the former should be allowed to dominate the latter. But once we admit that it is proper for the instructed classes to give tuition to the uninstructed, we begin to see an almost boundless vista for possible human betterment." In other words, people like him are going to teach the lower classes on how to behave, on how society should be instructed, and that they should be very willing to pay taxes so that the whole progressive era agenda, including eugenics, can take place. So he was a very arrogant person. The upshot of it is the Austrians, as small a school as they were, saw the Great Depression, saw the boom and the bubble of the 1920s. They understood why it was happening, what was causing it, what were the theoretical reasons for all this taking place. And their concern accelerated as the bubble blew up and then ultimately revealed to be correct in 1929 and early 1930s. Much of the same story takes place in the 1960s and 70s, as well as the 1990s, and then again, of course, in the years leading up to the housing bubble and the current economic crisis. So it's just a short little history here. The 1960s were a period of boom in the economy. They were referred to as the go-go 60s, and it was really an unprecedented boom in the economy since there was 9 straight years without a recession, and economic growth was running at a very high rate. There was a boom in the stock market. This was especially true in areas of technology. So companies like IBM and Xerox, Kodak, Polaroid. I think Polaroid must be out of business by now, but they had the camera. You could take a picture, and then the film inside the camera would develop on the spot. You would have a picture on the spot, and that was nifty technology. And the 50 technology companies, as a matter of fact, were called the Nifty 50. And the gains in those stocks were tremendous, particularly in the second half of the 1960s. It was a period of relatively low inflation and low unemployment in the economy. The United States got involved in the Vietnam situation in 1961. Ultimately, we'd be stationing over 500,000 people, troops in Vietnam. There was the civil rights movement, of course, in the 1960s, and another big event was the space program. And this was the heyday of Keynesian economics. Keynes wrote his general theory in 1936. It quickly swept the profession. Even Austrian economists such as Lionel Robbins and Gottfried Hoppler basically denounced their former association with the Austrian school and Oscar Morgenstern, and they took up new research agendas, staying mightily away from topics related to macroeconomics and the business side. But it basically swept academic economics, and so by 1960, the profession could be considered the majority Keynesian, and by the end of the 1960s, almost fully Keynesian. There were almost no Austrian economists, and those that remain basically pick up microeconomic topics and methodology and that sort of thing. But Keynesian economics had swept the table and was fully in charge. Real disposable income in the 1960s on a per capita basis was up 35%, which is high relative to other decades. And as I mentioned earlier, there was no recession in the U.S. economy 1961 to 1970. And one of the things to look out for with booms and busts is that the longer the period where you have no recessions would seem to indicate that the probability of a new crisis is increasing rather than decreasing. And as you get to those long periods of continued prosperity, such as it is, you start to see people saying the business cycle is dead, we've cured the problem of the business cycle, and so forth. So there was no recession, and that was the longest period of sustained prosperity until more recent times. Hey, this is economist Arthur Okun. Okun was a professor at Yale University, like Irving Fisher. He was an economist on the President's Council of Economic Advisers, which is indicated that he's a very prominent economist. He was very much a Keynesian economist, and he was during the Johnson administration, I think from 1967 through 1969. And when he reflected back in his book, which was published in 1970, he said, quote, "The persistence of prosperity has been the outstanding fact of American economic history of the 1960s. The absence of recession for nearly 9 years marks a discrete and dramatic departure from the traditional performance of the American economy." So he's clearly under the impression that it was Keynesian economics, the ability to engineer the economy and to stabilize the macroeconomic economy, which was responsible for that unprecedented period of economic prosperity. Okay, so Arthur Okun, again, was a Keynesian economist. He firmly believed that Keynesian economics, the scientific management, so-called, of the macroeconomy, is what kills off the business cycle. And indeed, there were a lot of discussions at the time of whether or not forces on the business cycle should be no longer taught at American universities. And indeed, many colleges and universities have either stopped teaching or taken out of the curriculum the standard course on business cycles, which we'll talk about the history of business cycles and the theories of the business cycle and things of that sort. Okun was very confident in this approach, in the scientific management of the economy, where we use fiscal policy and monetary policy to a certain extent to stabilize the economy, to keep animal spirits at bay, so that there's an ever increasing tendency for the economy to move higher. In his view, the New Deal was a success. With what Roosevelt was able to do during the New Deal was absolutely a success. Of course, it's hard to make that case given that we remain within the Great Depression during the entire period of the New Deal. Modern economists that not only recognize that the New Deal was not a success, but actually that New Deal policies are what actually continued the Great Depression over a long period of time by exactly what the Austrians have been saying, by preventing markets from clearing. And so the New Deal prevented markets from clearing and kept the Great Depression in place for a 10-year period. He said that fiscal religion was based on myths and superstition. Fiscal religion, he specifies, is a laissez-faire economy with a limited government and a balanced budget. So he's dismissing that and the idea that you should have a balanced budget, the government should be small, it should stay out of the economy, as myth and superstition, as a way of promoting his own ideas that, no, you should have an activist government that's managing the overall economy. And again, of course, he believes that the activist strategy employed during the 1960s of much larger government, much more government involvement in the economy, and an activist fiscal policy is what was responsible for the 1960s. And so he declared the business cycle dead and that we wouldn't have a business cycle anymore. Unfortunately for Okun, his book was released just as the recession of 1970 began. So he had been writing this book when he was on the Council of Economic Advisors. It was released, I think, in January of 1970, just as the next recession was beginning. Unemployment in the United States quickly rose from 4% to 6%. It retreated briefly to 5% before climbing to almost 9% by 1975. And unemployment in the United States remained above the normal level, above the natural rate of unemployment, as economists would say, for the next 20 years. And so, you know, if Okun's scientific management of the economy, he thought that was working, well, it certainly didn't work during the 1970s. Price inflation in the United States from 1965 to 1980 increased by 177%. Consumer price index was up 177%. And that's at a much higher rate than almost in any period prior to that in U.S. Peacetime history. And so what we were engaging on, just as Okun's book, The Political Economy of Prosperity, where he sort of lays out the Keynesian apparatus and why it's so great. And right after he said that, or after he published that, we began the stagflation of the 1970s, where we had more or less a continuous bout of higher inflation rates in the CPI, higher unemployment rates in labor markets, and a generally stagnant or unstable market economy. The Bretton Woods system fails during this time. Nixon took us off the gold standard in August of 1971. He imposed comprehensive wage and price controls because inflation had risen to over 4%. And if you look at this overall period from 1970, the beginning of 1970, through this entire period, in inflation-adjusted terms, stock market lost more than half of its value. So if you bought and held, it would have taken you more than 12 years just to recoup your investment, more or less make any money. And then the whole period ends in 1980-1981 with a period of, it can only be described as a depression, because the unemployment rate reached 10% on two occasions during this period. And the American economy was suffering mightily, along with most people in the United States, the U.S. economy. Now, Austrians were on this one as well. Despite our small numbers at the time, Henry Hazlitt was issuing regular warnings, Newsweek and other publications, about the growing size of the government, about monetary inflation, about price inflation, about the weaknesses and the inherent instability of the Bretton Woods system, about higher taxes and high marginal tax rates, corporate tax rates, so forth, deficits in the economy, which today, I mean, it seemed like a drop in the bucket, but back then, Hazlitt knew them as signs of warning of economic trouble. One of the readings for this class, Rothbard's Economic Depression, Their Cause and Cure, he wrote that in 1969, published it in 1969. So he was obviously warning people, reminding people that the economic and financial system was still prone to economic crises. And he was explaining that, as we've seen, the cause and cure of economic crisis. Ludwig von Mises, in his last public appearance, warned of the dangers of the current, at the time, monetary and fiscal policy of the U.S., and that they were presenting dangers to the future stability of the gold standard. And, of course, they were all correct. Mises was spot on about the dangers of the gold standard. Hazlitt was as well. The idea that the U.S. was printing up a lot of money to pay for the Vietnam War, the expansion of government, space program, and all the rest, and that those dollars were going overseas, and central banks overseas were increasingly wanting their money back in exchange for gold, and ultimately that forced Nixon's hand to shut the gold window to prevent the exodus of U.S. gold holders. Now we're going to fast forward to the tech or dot-com bubble. It was originally known as the tech bubble, and then later on more commonly called the dot-com bubble. And I think that's primarily because the early phase of both the bubble and the crash were in technology companies. And then later it seemed like the dot-com companies that were selling things on the internet were ultimately succumbed to economic problems and went out of business. Okay, in this paper, Who Predicted the Bubble, Who Predicted the Crash, which was published by the Independent Review in 2004, basically we were reviewing, you know, what economists were saying in the late 1990s. And on page 7 and 8 of that paper, I basically show what the mainstream, the, you know, the major mainstream economists were saying about bubbles. They were saying some really remarkable things, ridiculous things, you know, claiming that the stock market bubble of the 1920s wasn't really a bubble, that there's really no such thing as bubbles. If bubbles exist, we couldn't know it, or if bubbles exist, we couldn't do anything about it. And so mainstream economists in the aftermath of the tech crash were completely puzzled by even the nature and existence of a bubble. Prior to that, on January 2000, we took a survey information about mainstream economists, and they were basically euphoric about the future of the U.S. economy. There was very little concern there would be a correction in the market. There was very little concern about a recession in the economy. Most people were optimistic, projecting high rates of economic growth, and that's all detailed in the paper about who was saying what. And listing the survey information from 1992 to 2002. And it's interesting, when the economy is on trend growth, it seems like mainstream forecasters at the budget office, at the White House, Wall Street economists and so forth, they get the trend. I mean, if the trend is level, it's even, it's stable, their predictions are pretty good. It's only when it really matters, when you have a bubble and bust period, that their forecasts were much more widely off the mark. They under-predicted the bubble, and they missed the bust as well by a wide margin. And in the literature of the day, there were at least three books. The first one predicted, was titled and predicted Dow 36,000, so that the Dow would be rising hundreds of percent over a short period of time. And then shortly after that, a book came out called Dow 40,000. And ultimately, Ralph Antonpura, a stock market predictor and forecaster, published a book called Dow 100,000. So as you go into this bubble, mainstream economists are completely buying into it. That's exactly what's going to happen. We're going to continue the bubble forever. On the Austrian side of things, there were numerous warnings. And it wasn't all Austrians. There were a few other people who got the bubble. And I think it's important to point them out. I highlight Dean Baker, who's a neo-Keynesian sort of economist, but is a great market watcher. And he definitely saw the bubble and wrote about the bubble. Charles Murray, American Institute of Economic Research, in October of 1999, warned of a bubble and possible crash based on the high valuation of the stock market. So he wasn't using a theory. He was just looking at, were the numbers in line with normal natural trends in the economy? He also noted that the euphoria in the economy and about the future of the stock market was a warning of impending problems. James Grant said there was a problem with this prosperity all the way back in 1996. So he got it too early. And this is often a problem for Austrians, is if you apply the theory, you think it's going to happen, all these events are going to happen very quickly, or quicker than turns out that they are. And so that's something we all have to watch out for, is, you know, the timing issue is something that does not alert us. With Austrian economics doesn't really help as much with timing of these macroeconomic events. But James Grant points out an interesting approach to bubble warnings, and that bubbles are the result of fundamental considerations. And these would be technological features, improvements, real good things that are happening in the economy. But there's financial considerations as well. And this is, you know, is the central bank pursuing an inflationary policy which puts too many resources into these new fundamental technological advances? And finally, there's the psychological aspect of all this. So you have FFP, fundamental, financial, and psychological. And that if the financial funnels into the fundamental, aspects of the economy, it tends to create an euphoria or psychological high in the economy, which makes people speculate in investments even more. And in effect, these combination of factors is what drive economic bubbles. And then you just got a whole host of Austrian economists and Austrian-oriented financial analysts who are writing about the bubble as it takes place, giving the cause of why it's taking place, and warning ultimately of significant problems. And a lot of these warnings occurred in 1999 and early 2000. Christopher Meyer, writing to the Free Market for the Mises Institute, warned about the bubble, the tech bubble in the year 2000. Tony Deaton, an Austrian-oriented financial analyst, warned in 1999 and gave very precise reasons why we were in a bubble. Ido Holzman, in 1999, in the fall of 1999, gave a very detailed analysis of the bubble and the theory behind it. And of course, these are all referenced in the paper. George Reisman, in 1999, year 2000, discussed various reasons why we were in a bubble, suggested that it doesn't make sense that everybody can be living off of day trading in the economy. And you can just see his blood burning in anger about the impending crash in the economy. Many, many other Austrians, Sean Corrigan, Robert Blumen, Hans Senhold, William Anderson, all warned of a bubble in 1999. And if you go on to Mises.org, into the wiki area, you'll find entries in there on Austrians who warned of the housing bubble, and Austrians who warned of I think there's three different entries where there's a long list of Austrians who put out warnings about this. Finally, I want to mention Jude Dominski. On the right page here. Who in year 2000 issued a warning where he said that he was concerned about the stock market because people had all this capital gains that they had been accumulating through the bubble, and that they were going to have to pay taxes on those capital gains in the year 2000, April. And so he cautioned about investing in the stock market during that period because he thought people would be pulling out money, which would cause lower stock prices, which might even sort of snowball out of control, causing a crash. And so he didn't really warn of a boom-bust cycle so much as he gave us a trigger mechanism which initiates the change from the boom conditions to the bust conditions. There's always got to be some trigger out there that changes psychology in the market that makes everybody go from euphoric to depressed about stock market conditions. So that's another thing that is really more of an art than a science. It takes an awareness of what's going on in the economy and what's going to be coming up in the economy and how that might result in a trigger mechanism that would bring a bubble down. On page 25 of the paper, I write in the conclusion, quote, "It is especially noteworthy that all the Austrian predictions provided an economic explanation of the bubble and that their explanations were relatively consistent across the group. In generalize, the Austrians perceived the Fed to be following a loose monetary policy that kept interest rates below the rates that would have prevailed in the absence of that policy. Individual writers emphasized the Fed's willingness to bail out investors consistently during the 1990s, thereby desensitizing investors to risk. As a result, a period of exuberance and wild speculation took place, culminating in a hysteria of stock market bubble, of a stock market bubble." Okay, well, I ran over a little bit. see if I can get to see if we have any questions here. Well, Q&A is empty. We've got in the chat. Do we have access to the PowerPoint slides? Well, I'll have to let, there they go. Ken's got them up there. Thank you, Patrick, for putting that up. Be interested to look at that. Free copy of Lionel Robbins, America's Great, no, The Great Depression, excuse me. Patrick writes, few non-Austrian names that come to mind as far as the dot-com bubble is concerned. Dean Baker, yes, I mentioned him. Wayne Godley, Eric Jensen, Michael Hudson, Robert Shiller. I think Robert Shiller is certainly a prominent member there. I'm not really familiar with the three in the middle, but Shiller is rightly famous for being correct about modern economic bubbles. He's from the financial economic side of things and the psychological side of things, and so he's very much like Charles Murray from the American Institute for Economic Research, where he's looking at the data and attempting to see if certain markets and certain prices have gone outside the normal bounds, where, you know, you'll see a certain price in the economy or a certain market in the economy trade between certain highs and certain lows, and if you find those same prices or markets trading very high above the norm or the trends, it's a way of detecting bubbles. However, because Shiller doesn't have any theoretical grounding in the cause of economic bubbles, other than just psychologically speculation and so forth, his remedies for booming busts and bubbles are very complicated. It's almost like an Urban Fisher approach. We're going to stabilize everything. We're going to ensure all marketplaces and things of that nature. Okay, Garrett asks, what do Austrian economists say about our current economic situation? Well, the Austrian economists that I talk to are very concerned about our current economic situation. I think almost all of them disagree with the policies that have been pursued. That they're very concerned about what's been going on with the Federal Reserve, and that instead of making markets more stable, they're making markets less stable, that the government has been bailing out various sectors of the economy, notably the banking sector, notably the housing sector, and that's a problem. They are probably making the underlying economic fundamentals, the underlying economic fundamentals of the American economy. They're encouraging and sustaining bubble-related activities. They've made banks that were too big to fail, apparently too big to fail, they're making them even bigger and more likely to fail. So in general, I would say that Austrian economists are concerned about the current economic situation, and they're very concerned about the direction of economic policy. Why hasn't the current growth of monetary aggregates resulted in more price inflation in consumer goods? Very good question. A lot of the growth in monetary aggregates has caused higher prices in the economy, but not in the area of consumer goods, at least not yet. With the exception of food and fuel, which of course the Fed likes to take out of the consumer price index when they look at things. But if we look around the economy, we see higher prices in a lot of different areas. We see bond prices at historic highs. We see the stock market at an historic high, as high as it's ever been, basically. We've seen return to inflation in home prices, all-time record prices in Washington, D.C. and in Manhattan, and significant upticks in housing prices around the country, particularly the Sand States. Sand States are Arizona, Nevada, Florida, to a certain extent California. Those areas have experienced significant increases from the crash level prices in the economy. You see record prices in the contemporary art market, as all those wealthy hedge fund owners are diversifying their investments into contemporary art, so-called. Farmland prices, historically high rates, and so oil prices at pretty high rates. Interesting thing to check for yourself in terms of looking at predicting boom and bust. If you look at the graph of oil prices over time, it's overlaid with recession periods. You'll see the oil prices rise and peak right before a recession, and then after the during and after the recession, prices fall back rather dramatically. So the inflation has not gotten into consumer prices, largely because the money, there's a lot of consumers out there who are at the very edge of their standard of living. They're living paycheck to paycheck. They're having to cut corners. They don't have any savings. And so with such a large portion of the U.S. population, historically high percentages of people on food stamps, for example, there's a big chunk of American consumers who are in a cutback mode rather than expansionary mode. And all the money that the Fed has been trying to create is in a lot fewer hands, basically. Question from Jeff. Why aren't more journalists favorable to the Austrian viewpoint given their superior predictions? Well, just like the Austrian school had almost gone out of existence by the time of the early 1980s, and there weren't any financial journalists covering the Austrian economists at all, except what Henry Hazlitt had been writing in the 1950s and 60s. There's a few more journalists who are covering the Austrian viewpoint. There's many people on the internet with internet interview programs. I do a number of shows that are radio stations or internet programs, and I'm available to do those kind of interviews and to help out journalists. That's one of the things I do here at the Mises Institute. I kind of like run the help desk so that when students or professors or the media call in, I speak to them and give them answers about, what's going on in Austrian economics or what's going on in the economy. the so there's a few out there. There's a little bit of influence at Barron's. Gene Epstein is a follower of the Austrian school. James Grant is somebody who gets onto the mainstream media. He's very well respected. He's a great writer. He's very perceptive about the economy. So you'll see him in places like the Wall Street Journal and on CNBC, things of that nature. But he sells his advice, and so he doesn't like to give it away all the time. You'll see, you're starting to see a few Austrian-oriented pieces in Forbes magazine and other outlets, so that the growth in that direction is, there is growth in that direction, but it's still, I share your disappointment that journalists haven't really looked into the Austrian viewpoint, because if you look at the mainstream media, they're all saying the same thing, and they're all towing the mainstream line with regards to economic events, whether it's the government shutdown or tapering or whatever it happens to be. But we certainly encourage journalists to come to Mises.org and get educated. Patrick writes, speaking of the contemporary art market, Sotheby's stock recently broke above $50. Well, that's another good, actually, indicator of the economy, and whether it's in bubble or bust mode. When you're in a bubble, specifically, or when you're in a significant boom period in the economy, because the boom is being driven by the central bank, and specifically through financial markets, there is a great deal of wealth that is thrown into the hands of the participants, the primary participants in the financial markets. And so they end up taking some of that newfound wealth and investing it into art as a way of self-congratulation, I guess. I don't think most of the people that are in this category that I'm talking about were typically interested in art. It's just that they ended up with so much money that they got into the art market. Sotheby's stock price is a good indicator. When it's very high, it's indicative of boom conditions. And right now, the two hot things are contemporary art, which is very popular in New York area. The hip thing sort of to do for in Manhattan. Less so, if you look at contemporary art, I probably speculate that most people in the class probably wouldn't appreciate it very much. I'm famous for saying contemporary art, you break it down into con, which is sort of a con game, it's not real, and temporary, which means that most of that is not going to be considered great art over the long haul. Also hot in the art market is Chinese and Asian art. And there's been a lot of billionaires and multimillionaires created over in China for fundamental reasons, but also because they have a bubble economy driven by government policy. And as a consequence, they were interested in purchasing art from historical art, contemporary art that was Chinese-oriented. The same thing happened during the Japanese stock bubble. The Japanese invested heavily in French Impressionist art, and every auction would be new, all-time record prices for French Impressionists. Do you have any proof that F.A. Hayek also predicted the Great Depression? I did research in German for my PhD thesis. I could not find at least an accurate prediction in his work before the Great Depression. Well, that's interesting, Michael. I don't have proof that F.A. Hayek predicted the Great Depression. Mark Skousen wrote that in one of his books. And I asked him about that, and he said that he had looked into it, and he could not find anything. He had various German things translated, and he was not able to establish any written prediction or warning by Hayek about the Great Depression. But apparently, in an interview towards the end of Hayek's life, he did remark that he had warned of the Great Depression. And I don't know if that warning was somehow tucked away in some of his writings, or if he just mentioned it to colleagues. So I don't know what the exact specific nature of Hayek's prediction regarding the Great Depression is, but his theoretical work would suggest that he was aware. The fact that he was working with von Mises, attending his seminar, and working in the Austrian Institute for Business Cycle Research, I speculate that he would be aware of the problems and the economic conditions that were unfolding. Okay. Are there any other questions? Okay, Roy writes, so where is all this money going? Good question. I think that my previous answer, I did sort of lay out where the money is going in terms of price inflation. To supplement that answer, I would note, of course, that that banks are holding a huge amount of excess reserves. So in addition to their required reserves, the banking system is holding $2 trillion of excess reserves. These are reserves that they could lend out in the economy, but that they're failing to do so. Small part of that is the Fed is paying interest on those reserves, so they're taking a small amount of money with respect to their holdings of reserves at the Fed. And then another big part of that, a bigger part of that, is that banks are not interested in investing or loaning money, particularly at for long-term loans. I think they'd be willing to lend short-term, but there's short-term interest rates are so low, and that market is so flooded by the Fed that there's no room there, which suggests higher rates would be probably good for the economy. And so they don't find a lot of tempting loan opportunities, given that interest rates are so low and the returns on loans are so low and the likelihood of losses are relatively high with respect to the loans not being paid back or inflation picking up and, raising nominal interest rates above the rates that they were lending at. So for a variety of reasons, banks are unwilling to lend. As I described earlier, we don't have normal economic conditions in the U.S. economy. We don't have normal economic policy. And also hanging above their head is regulations, Dodd-Frank regulations that regulate financial markets as applied to banks. Not only is the legislation huge and encumbering, but a lot of it is yet to be written and promulgated and put into effect. So there's a lot of subsections of Dodd-Frank which have to be written by regulators, put out for public comment, and put into effect. And so bankers don't know. And as a matter of fact, I think it took them a while to learn the primary elements of Dodd-Frank. For example, during the housing crisis, I applied for a mortgage, and my credit rating is as high as you can get, which was 830, I think, at the time. They changed the credit ratings. And the bank denied me the loan. And when I went and I confronted them, their reason for denying me the loan, given that my credit rating is as good or better than anybody else, they couldn't tell me why. And it was only after I went to another bank did I find out that one of the new rules is that if you try to take out a mortgage on a property that you paid cash for, that you're not allowed to take out a new loan. In other words, if you've been able to buy a house with cash and you're taking out a loan to improve the house, the banks are not allowed to lend for an extended period of time. So it's a crazy rule that someone who can buy a house for cash and have the best possible credit rating is denied a loan on that basis. I've talked to other bankers about that, and I think it's ridiculous. But that's what actually happened. The bank in question did not know why they were turning me down, but they turned me down because of some element of the new rules. Okay, last question by Roy is, does the lack of willingness to lend have something to do with Robert Higgs' regime on certainty thesis? Yes, it does. Robert Higgs' regime on certainty thesis basically states that when the political regime at the time was creating uncertainty for entrepreneurs to invest and maybe in effect taking an adversarial stance towards investors, that entrepreneurs are unwilling to act because it's not just economic uncertainty that they have to face, but it's tax and regulatory, inflationary uncertainty. And so you can take a plethora of things: Obamacare, Dodd-Frank, environmental regulation, higher taxes, looming deficits, Federal Reserve policy. All of the main arms of government are creating a great deal of uncertainty, and in most cases, the level of uncertainty is too high for entrepreneurs who have their plans, making their calculations, but given the level of political uncertainty, they're unwilling to make those investments. And so if they're not making those investments, then they're not buying capital goods, and they're not hiring labor. And as a result, you have a stagnant economy and higher than necessary rates of unemployment. So that's an excellent question. I did discuss elements of it, but it all does come under the rubric of Robert Higgs' regime uncertainty thesis. And Robert Higgs is one of our great economists. He is the editor of the Independent Review, was until recently. And he's the author of a number of fine journal articles and books on the economy. And his Crisis in Leviathan, classic, and his more recent book on economic depressions and war is a great collection of his Masterworks. And so that's another thing to put on your to-do list, on your Christmas gift list, and put it into your library. So with that, I'll call the class closed and wish you all good night.